This is the Book Report, opening windows, opening worlds. Brought to you by Windows, a Bookshop, a community-centered, locally owned independent bookstore in Monroe, Louisiana. Hello and welcome to the Book Report. I'm Elizabeth Grant Gibson.
And I'm Pat Grant. Today on the Book Report, our theme is fading communities. If that sounds scary and a bit depressing, well, in some ways it is. We'll talk first to novelist William J. Cobb, whose new novel, Goodnight, Texas, is an elegy to a Texas Gulf Coast town that is quietly becoming obsolete as the shrimping industry dies out.
In the second half hour, we'll talk to Stacy Mitchell, author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers, and The Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Mitchell has gathered some surprising information about the effects of big box chain retailers on communities, especially small and medium-sized cities and towns. And just so that we don't all find ourselves grumpy and anxious for the rest of the day, we'll spend our final segment talking to Mary Gay Shipley, owner of That Bookstore in Blytheville. Her Arkansas community is fighting back with a plan to help local independent businesses grow stronger so that they can coexist along with the big chains without having to close their doors.
It's going to be a big show today, so settle in for a look at the economic challenges facing our communities and some solutions to keep local businesses moving forward and thriving. We'll get started with the Book Buzz.
Since we're approaching the end of 2006, lots of best book of the year lists are being published. It's interesting that for many of the best-known list makers, their best books of the year are really very different than their bestsellers that they publish each week. The Book Sense bestseller list that we talk about on this show offer a better sense of what books are being recognized as truly the best. The Book Sense lists are compiled from reporting by hundreds of independent booksellers across the country, and since those reports of actual books are of actual books sold at the counter, there are no hyperlogarithmic formulas for assessing books ordered from publishers, ordered from distributors, and sold at stores to come up with some listing that may not, in actual fact, really mean that the books on it are the biggest sellers. Books have a very short shelf life in the largest book chains, so after 60 or 90 days, shelf space for a given title is reduced, stock is returned, and those 15 minutes of fame are over.
So, we're going to present some of the Book Sense best-selling books of the year. Book Sense has published lists in six categories with the 15 top sellers in each included. A handful of standard blockbusters have made it onto these lists, but for the most part, you'll see books that reflect the tastes of the independent stores and the independent readers who shop there. We'll start with a look at the Book Sense list of hardcover fiction bestsellers for 2006. The top-selling work of fiction at independent bookstores across the country was Water for Elephants by Sarah Grun. The remaining 14 on the list in order are For One More Day by Mitch Albom, Blue Shoes and Happiness by Alexander McCall Smith, Sweet Francaise by Irene Nemirovsky, 13 Moons by Charles Frazier, Digging to America by Ann Tyler, 12 Sharp by Janet Ivanovich, Cell by Stephen King, The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, In the Company of the Courtesan by Sarah Dunant, Beach Road by James Patterson, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, Every Man by Philip Roth, The Tenth Circle by Jodi Picoult, and A Dirty Job by Christopher Moore. You have heard us feature many of these books on the Book Report.
The Book Sense hardcover nonfiction bestsellers for 2006 are, in order, Marley and Me by John Grogan. We call that the book that just won't quit because it keeps on going like the Energizer Bunny. The World is Flat by Thomas L. Friedman. State of Denial by Bob Woodward. Freakonomics by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner. I Feel Bad About My Neck by Nora Ephron. The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick. Cesar's Way by Cesar Millan and Melissa Jo Peltier. The Audacity of Hope by Barack Obama. Wisdom of Our Fathers by Tim Russert. The Innocent Man by John Grisham. Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. Our Endangered Values by Jimmy Carter. And Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And if you want to see Pat's wonderful review of I Feel Bad About My Neck by Nora Ephron, you can go to www.thebookreport.net. Book Report. That's thebookreport.net, as in nothing but net. And go to Pat's blog, and that is one of her entries on there.
We'll save the paperback list for next week. Normally, at this time, the Book Report On the Book Report, we talk about authors who are touring the South. This week, we're going to talk about someone else who's touring the South. Her name is Wanda Jewell, and she's executive director of the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance, known familiarly among those of us who are members as SIBA. Wanda was inspired by Oprah's Gift of Giving Back show. You may have seen the same episode. Oprah gave $1,000 and a video camera to everyone in the audience and told them to go out and do good works with their money, videotaping as they went. Wanda decided that she could manage $1,000, and she had a camcorder to boot. So she saddled up and headed out into the southern region, where she began visiting independent bookstores.
At each of the 10 stores she'll visit, Wanda is giving away $100 by buying books for people. What better charitable act could there be? Her philanthropical journey began right in her own town of Columbia, South Carolina, at the Happy Bookseller, where, according to Shelf Awareness, an online newsletter, Wanda helped a shocked high school junior buy a book of poetry as a Christmas present for a friend. The student told The State, Columbia's newspaper, that, quote, "it was a wonderful surprise. You don't find that sort of kindness anymore," close quote. Anymore? Indeed, or maybe ever.
Wanda's journey will continue through 4 days, and then she will spend 4 days working during the holiday rush at Page and Palette in Fairhope, Alabama. That should keep her in touch with the problems facing her member bookstores on a daily basis.
That's right. And in just a moment, we're going to be back with William J. Cobb. We want to remind you again of that website, easy for me to say, www.thebookreport.net. We would love to hear from you. You can reach us at mail@thebookreport.net. And please send us your reviews on either typed or on an MP3 format to reviews@thebookreport.net. We will be back in just a moment on The Book Report with William J. Cobb. One of the most important ways to keep a community strong and thriving is to keep local merchants strong and thriving. Small businesses create the majority of new jobs in our country every year, and local retail businesses are a great boon to the economy of any town. According to the American Independent Business Alliance, each dollar spent at a local business returns 48 cents to the community, while a dollar spent at a chain returns just 17 cents, and a dollar spent on the internet returns 0 cents to the community. Local business owners create jobs, and the merchants and their employees spend money at local restaurants and with local lawyers and accountants. They shop at other local retailers and contribute greatly to the local tax base. Local business owners are well known for their charitable efforts and support for local sports teams and schools. There's nothing like the personal service you'll get from your own neighbors. So shop local whenever possible.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And thank you for staying with us on The Book Report. William J. Cobb's short stories and essays have been published widely in magazines and journals, including The New Yorker. He has published a collection of stories, The White Tattoo, a previous novel, The Fire Eaters, and now his new novel is Good Night, Texas. He has received an NEA grant and the award for the novel from the Associated Writing Programs, among other honors, and currently he directs the writing program at Pennsylvania State University. William Cobb, thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Good. Tell us a little bit about how you came to writing, please. Yes.
Excuse me, could you repeat that?
Tell us a little bit about how you came to writing.
How I came to writing, I think I was either blessed or cursed with it. I know that even when I was in the second grade, I was writing songs, and I wrote all through grade school and high school, and I never thought I would really make any money at it or be any success, but I like doing it.
Mm-hmm. 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 That's good, because then if success didn't come immediately,
at least you're having fun.
Doing something you enjoy. Did you have a little band as well? Did you perform your songs?
No, I think I have the worst singing voice on the planet. And although I really always wanted to be Bob Dylan.
Who also has the worst singing voice on the planet.
Yeah, maybe I couldn't do, you know, I don't think I could ever get close to Bob.
I mean, he's spent almost 50 years at the top of many different charts. Okay, let's talk about Goodnight Texas, your newest book, which was released in hardcover by Unbridled Books in October of this year. Goodnight by the Sea is a town on the Texas Gulf Coast. It's a town where the shrimping industry is drying up and the town is slowly dying with it. But from the beginning of the novel, there's a sense that something is coming. Some event, large in its strangeness, will visit this town. The giant striped fish that is found by the pier, it seems to be a portent of what might come. Talk a little bit about that bizarre discovery.
Well, years ago, that Colonel, an idea of the novel occurred in a dream, and I woke up from an afternoon nap, and I had dreamed of a giant fish with a horse in its mouth and a kind of Viking funeral at sea.
Wow.
Where you put the Viking's body in the ship and mm-hmm. light the ship aflame and push it out into the waves.
Right.
So those are two of the key moments in the novel. And of course, once I have that idea comes out of my subconscious, then you try to put it in some greater framework. Mm-hmm. And the town of Goodnight by the Sea is based, it's kind of a mythologized location of my town I grew up in high school, which is Rockport, Texas, north of Corpus mm-hmm. Christi.
Right.
And many of the elements, such as the fishing industry on the skids and tourism rising, but the locals being very resentful of the tourists in general, are taking place in my hometown.
Right. So mm-hmm. so then the fictional Goodnight is sort of north of Corpus, south of Austin.
Oh, certainly. Yes.
Just floating around in there. Okay. Well, the people in this fictional town are like, and I just want to say, I'm going to go back to that fish for a minute. Those who haven't read the novel, you have a very interesting image awaiting you, because this fish that actually washes up is quite shocking and very, very interesting. And then it sort of takes on a life of its own in the story. The people in this town are like those in all towns. Some are good. Some are bad. Some are as yet to be determined. We're not completely sure. But all of them are very interesting. In your fiction, do you focus on character, or as opposed to being very plot driven?
Oh, I would certainly say character, in the sense that the people decide what the story is going to be, mm-hmm. and what those people do and how they act out their lives decide the events, and rather than the events deciding the people.
Yeah.
And certainly, for instance, some of my favorite characters, one of my favorite characters is Oscar Martinez, the kind of part-time tow truck driver, part-time taxidermist.
Right. And is he the uncle, actually, of the...
He's a cousin of Gabriel.
Cousin of Gabriel, that's what it is. Okay.
And he's resentful and funny and unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've known people like him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other character that I probably had the most fun with was the Russian Gusev Smirnov of mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. Who owns the cafe. And people have compared him to Borat, but I don't think that I of course wrote this a long time before.
Well, he was pre-Borat, right. But he's also very different in that he's quirky and sardonic, but he's nice too. He's really nice.
Oh, he's really benevolent
mm-hmm.
and he does some of the most good in the town and looks after his, you know, his friends and his workers.
Right.
And he's really quite intelligent. and shrewd,
right.
Although he doesn't always give that away in what he says, but more and so in what he does.
Right, and he's an immigrant who has taken full advantage of the American dream. He owns the little diner. He owns the motel. You can see that he is creating a place. He is the Donald Trump, if you will, of Goodnight by the Sea.
I knew people exactly like this, in particular a Polish fellow who was kind of like the classic example of a capitalist and was making more money than all of us because he was such an investor, and he was just a shrewd fellow.
Right, right.
How dangerous is it to write a hurricane into a novel in the period following Hurricane Katrina?
Well, I wrote it before Katrina, mainly in 2004 when I was living on the branch of the former Texas writer J. Frank Dobie, which is a six-month fellowship, and the ranch is near Austin, Texas. And, of course, big hurricanes hit the Texas coast, but there's been kind of a lull, and most of the hurricanes lately have gone towards Florida, and then, of course, Katrina happened after I had written the novel. So I was imagining something kind of projecting into the future, and then Katrina came along, and there are certainly similarities in especially the storm surge aspect of the story.
Right.
That's just my little element of prophecy, I guess.
Right. Well, and your hurricane is fast and violent, leaving behind tons of muck. But in some ways, it's almost like it also washes the town clean. I mean, it sets up some new beginnings, some new possibilities.
When I lived in this town on the Texas coast, there's this certainly an element of the population that actually wants hurricanes to come along. And I knew a lot of construction workers, for instance. And, you know, most of the hurricanes aren't nearly as devastating as Katrina. And often you have almost no loss of life and or serious injury. But they destroy the piers, they destroy, you know, some of the buildings along the shoreline. Because, of course, most hurricanes aren't as violent and as wicked as Katrina was.
Right, but lots of roof work afterwards, usually. And
oh, my. All the construction work, and I did construction work all through, you know, high school and early college years. They just saw it as a big bonanza. And then, of course, everything would get reconstructed, and then another hurricane would come along and cause some more work, but not the kind of total devastation of flooded neighborhoods.
And in your book, the ending really keeps you from feeling a sense of hopelessness that you might feel with a town that seems to be dying, and then it has this big disaster, because it does, instead, there is this sense of hope at the end of new promise and so forth. Now, you were raised in Texas. Have you seen small communities dying out or else expanding to unrecognizable size?
Well, I can use my small town as a good example in that I was there in 2005, I think, was the last time I was just there in my small town. And it's much more touristy than it ever was before. And there are condos and hotels right along the water, beautiful condos, hotels, that were never there before. And my own neighborhood, which I would always have thought was kind of a second-class beachfront neighborhood, now looks like a first-class beachfront neighborhood. Beautiful homes right on the water. And I know that, for instance, we bought our lot for $5,000 when we moved there. And I would imagine it'd be more like in the $100,000 range now, whatever. You know, just much more expensive than that.
Yeah.
And that's a change that sometimes the locals who aren't as wealthy, for instance, as the people from Houston or Dallas that are buying the homes there, can get resentful about. And I was the local, so I saw it from that perspective.
Yeah. I grew up in South Texas, and we used to go to Padre Island, which was just 40 miles away from us.
Oh, sure.
When there was only the Sea Grape Motel and the Sandy Retreat. And the first time I saw a high-rise hotel, it stunned me, and now it's unrecognizable to me. Well, our time has flown. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Book Report. This has been an interview with William J. Cobb. The book is Goodnight, Texas. You've got plenty of time to find it at an independent bookstore near you for yourself or for someone on your holiday gift list. Thank you so much. We'll be back in just a moment. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
One of the best things about local booksellers is that they are able to hand-sell books very well. What exactly does hand-selling mean? It means to literally pick up a book and place it in the hands of a customer. A good staff member at a local independent bookstore does this dozens of times every day, usually accompanied by a statement such as, "I couldn't put this one down and I think you'll love it too," or "Trust me on this one, and if you don't love it, just bring it back and exchange it," or "I ordered this one with you in mind." That's what independent booksellers do. They read books, they get to know their customers, and then they match up book with customer and everyone is happy. It's a great feeling when someone who actually knows you puts a book directly into your hand. If you haven't been to an independent bookseller lately, find one near you and make a visit. Independent, locally owned booksellers. That's how books were meant to be sold. Visit thebookreport.net to find an independent bookstore near you. Some communities treasure their independent local businesses, the shops that can give a town its own special flavor. Sometimes we don't realize how important it is to shop in those locally owned businesses, but the truth is that the strength of our community depends on it. According to the American Independent Business Alliance, every dollar spent at a locally owned business returns 47 cents to the community. A dollar spent in a chain store returns only 17 cents to the community, and a dollar spent on the internet returns 0 cents to the community. These dollars build streets and pay for water treatment. These dollars build and staff schools and libraries and parks. These dollars do all the things that improve quality of living for every one of us. So the next time you need to shop for a special pair of shoes or a new hammer or a great book to read, please buy local. For you, for your children, for your community, it's never been more important than right now to support independent, locally owned businesses, because strong local merchants are a sign of a strong community. And we're back with the Book Report. Stacy Mitchell is a senior researcher with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and she chairs the American Independent Business Alliance. Her previous book is The Hometown Advantage. Now she has written Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers, and The Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Stacy Mitchell, welcome to the Book Report.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Pat and I have asked you to talk to us today because we think your book is very important and that everyone who has an interest in building strong local communities with good economic futures must read it.
Tell us something about you, please. You're not a small independent retailer, so why are you interested in this mega retail problem?
Well, I work for this national nonprofit organization called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and it's an organization that's been around for 32 years now, and we have been advising communities and working on this idea of strengthening local economies, really decentralizing the economy. And several years ago, we started looking out there and seeing all of these fights that were going on where citizens were opposing Walmart stores and other big box retailers in their communities, and we started wondering, well, what are the impacts of those stores and why does this matter and are there things that communities can do, and started looking into it and discovered that there really are quite far-reaching impacts of big box retailers, and that there's also a lot that communities can do not to go in that direction. And so I started doing advising and writing about this and talking to folks, and it just sort of mushroomed into a full-time job pretty quickly. And so I've been doing this for a number of years, and I care very passionately about independent businesses and local communities, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to help a lot of groups around the country change direction.
That's great. Where did the enormous big box chains come from, and how did they saturate the marketplace so quickly?
Well, the growth, many of these chains, you can go back and find sort of the earliest examples of the big box retailers in particular, you know, in the 1960s. But they really took off in the starting in the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Yeah.
So what we've seen, if you look at the market share growth over the last 15 years, is really unprecedented in history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Home Depot and Lowe's, which barely existed 20 years ago, have since grown to capture half of all hardware and building supply sales. We've lost about 5,000 independent hardware stores in that period. Borders and Barnes & Noble, again, barely existed 20 years ago. Now they capture half of all bookstore sales. In 1998, which is very, very recent, in 1998, the top five supermarket chains in this country captured one out of every $4 that we spend on groceries. Today, the top five supermarket chains capture one out of every $2 that we spend on groceries.
Just
and you
amazing.
Can see this. Every single retail category, you know, there are two or three companies that have really grown to dominate. And Walmart, of course, dominates them all. Walmart is captures about one out of every $10 that Americans spend. It's the largest grocer in the country. It sells more toys, clothing, furniture, DVDs, CDs, jewelry, and a whole host of other products than any other retailer.
Wow.
It's amazing.
It really is interesting. And, you know, there's so many things in your book that are fascinating to me. One was that, you know, the very sort of beginnings of the spread of chains with A&P and then Sears and Ward's in the, I guess, the 20s, really. That was stifled after a while because local communities felt that it was, A, hurting the local economy, and, B, bringing in lower-wage jobs. And so until after World War II, really, those were almost stopped in their tracks in some ways. And it looks like we're coming to a place now where people are starting to sort of wake up and say, wait a minute, is this always the best for the community? Why do consumers like these stores, and why do city officials work so hard to bring them to town, even offering massive tax breaks and, you know, in a sense, really losing money on them?
Well, in terms of consumers, you know, I think that there's, you know, this idea that we're saving money and that these stores, I mean, there's, I think we're really, you know, we see a lot of the marketing and the advertising, and I think it's very easy to kind of get into this place where you think that these stores clearly must be superior, that they're the new thing, they're more advanced, that this is the direction things are going in, and that it offers a better experience and lower prices. And what I argue in the book is that we're, you know, we're paying a huge hidden cost for these retailers, that they are lowering our incomes much faster than they're lowering prices, that they're taking an enormous toll on the environment and on our communities, and that they're essentially forcing a lot of costs onto society, costs that we pay, but they don't show up on their price tags, and that this is really distorting the marketplace. Local communities, local governments often welcome these retailers because they think that they're going to get all these new jobs and it's going to be economic development. They're going to get all this new tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, we know quite conclusively that big box retailers actually eliminate more jobs than they create in a local economy.
And there's evidence to back that up, is there?
Yes, there was probably the most extensive study was released in April of this year by an economist at the University of California, Irvine, who looked, going back to the 1970s, looked at something like 3,000 Walmart store openings across the country and found that on average, Walmart stores cause a net loss of 180 jobs. Retail jobs. And the reason is that Walmart causes all these other businesses to downsize and close, and all those jobs that are lost at those other businesses end up adding up to more than the number of jobs at the new Walmart store. And there's a reason to believe that this same kind of impact is true, whether it's a Home Depot or a Target or any of these other retailers.
What's the financial impact? What size payroll is being lost in these counties where this is happening?
You know, I can't recall the exact number that
I think
found.
It was pretty close to $2 million.
Yes, that sounds right to me, too, that there was a substantial impact on the overall retail payroll. And he was only looking at the retail jobs.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to do in the book was to go the second level out, because we know that locally owned businesses spend a lot of their revenue locally. You know, they hire the local accountant, they bank at the local bank, they advertise in local media. You know, the chains don't have any need for those kinds of services. Most of the dollars that you spend in a national retailer, whether it's, you know, Borders Books or Walmart, just leave your community.
And they're overnight electronically deposited to Bentonville or Birmingham or wherever the case may be.
Yeah, and they obviously they don't need any local accountants, and they're not going to, they don't do a lot of local advertising because they do their big television ads and all that sort of thing. And I really, you know, we know we have numbers and studies. You know, you had a PSA talking some about this before I came on. And what I wanted to do was to kind of put a face on that. And so I did interviews in the book with local bankers, with small-town newspaper publishers, with farmers, with small manufacturers, you know, all of whom tell this same story about how their livelihoods have just been squeezed and how they're really threatened with losing their jobs and their businesses as a result of big box retailers because they don't have any need for their services. And it's really what we're seeing is the squeezing and the dismantling of the American middle class.
You had some amazing statistics in your book, and I was trying to flip through and find the exact page, but I couldn't. With a little state, maybe Nebraska or Iowa, somewhere out in the West, that during a certain time period of about 10 or 12 years, went from the first Walmart supercenter to a total of 43. And in that time, it shows the number of pharmacies and grocery stores and clothing shops and bookstores and so on and so forth, other kinds of businesses that closed over those ensuing years. And not certainly not 100% attributable to that, but certainly heavily affected by that. And the numbers were massive. It was about 2,100 other businesses that went out after, during this course of time when 43 of these big box superstores came in. And if anybody who's had a big superstore open in their community knows, you may have tons of employees out there on the floor for the first month or two, but attrition is pretty swift, and pretty soon you don't have the number of jobs that you thought were going to be available in that facility. What's this doing to middle-class America?
Well, we have actually, you know, for about 15 or 20 years now, statistics show that the middle class in this country is, in fact, shrinking, that the share of the national income flowing to the middle class is dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we've got more and more families who belong to the ranks of the working poor, you know, where you've got one or more wage earners who are working full-time, and they can't make enough to get by even on a very meager kind of living. We know, for example, a huge number of states have disclosed in the last few years that they have tens of thousands of big box employees enrolled in Medicaid, food stamps, housing, because they simply can't get by. You know, this is really a choice between two kinds of economies. There's the sort of Walmart big box economy where nobody connected to that, you know, whether it's the Chinese girl who made the product or the woman who's working at the cash register, is doing well. You know, or you've got an economy, the other choice is an economy built on small, locally owned businesses that are connected to domestic, local manufacturers, small farmers that are spending money in our communities that are creating all those middle-class jobs. I mean, that's the kind of economy that I think we really need to be going for.
This is really interesting because what you're saying in terms of things like the health care costs and so forth, the fact that a lot of people who are working not quite full-time, but 30 to 35 hours, which is very close to full-time, and in some states would be considered such, are not getting the health benefits, and some of them are ending up getting that through the state or the parishes or counties. In a sense, is Walmart shifting its health care costs for its employees to federal and state tax dollars?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, Walmart, and I should say that this is true of most of the other big boxes, too. I mean, Target's got people enrolled in the state, and Home Depot, and they all do. And the reason is they all offer health care programs to their employees, but in order to be eligible, you have to have worked there a certain length of time, and you have to be have a certain number of hours a week. So there's a lot of their employees who simply aren't eligible because they haven't been on the job long enough.
Right.
They have such high turnover.
Right.
But then the other thing is that the premiums are really high. The employee actually has to pay most of the cost. And if you're making $7, $8 an hour, you just can't afford those premiums. And so What ends up happening is these folks end up enrolling in Medicaid at big cost to state and federal taxpayers. And it's just one of a very long list of ways that, you know, we pay for these companies. You know, the cost to us, you know, it's not on their price tag, but we're paying it.
Yes, yeah. We are.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I know that there are, I mean, some of the things you talk about were really shocking to me. The things like chargebacks on invoices that these big box retailers can do to suppliers, and the suppliers really can't argue, or they get shut out of the thousands of stores that they could be selling to. And I know that this has hurt a lot of good, strong American companies like Rubbermaid, like Lovable, and some others. I know there are consumer protection laws on the books and federal laws about fair trade practices, and some of these things really don't seem like fair trade practices. Are these corporations violating the spirit, if not the letter, of these laws? And I mean, do these laws get enforced? Is government being a greater friend to the citizen or to the corporation?
We theoretically have laws on the books, both at the state and federal level, that prohibit some of the kinds of predatory practices that we're seeing out there on the part of these retailers. But we have largely stopped enforcing those laws, and to our own peril, I think. Two of the things that we're seeing big retailers do, one, you mentioned this pressure on manufacturers. You know, they're going to companies and not only pressuring them to move jobs overseas, but pressuring them for all these little favors and discounts and benefits that are not made available to independent retailers on the same terms. And so they're basically distorting the market and creating this competitive disadvantage for the independent retailers. And as you said, the manufacturers are in a position where they feel like they can't say no. And so they're giving favors to the big guys, and then they got to make that up somewhere. And so they end up charging the little guys more.
Right.
And so you end up with this distorted marketplace. The other thing that we see these retailers do is something called predatory pricing. And that's where, you know, Walmart is really the king of doing this. Back in the 1980s, when Walmart was expanding across the Midwest and in the Southeast, and its primary competitors in those small towns were local pharmacies and variety stores, Walmart priced, and we know this conclusively from court cases, Walmart priced its entire health and beauty department, you know, the kinds of things you'd buy in a pharmacy, below cost, below what it actually paid for those items. And it can make them up, make up the difference on all the other departments in the store.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And they can do that for months or years at a time. They can do that for months or years at a time until they really do drive the competition out.
Yeah, and then once they've done that, we see the prices go up, and they've done that consistently in one category after another. A few years ago, they wanted to have the toy business.
Mm-hmm.
So one holiday season, they sold their toys all below cost.
Wow.
And,
yeah,
you know, we saw Toys R Us and KB Toys go into a tailspin, file bankruptcy.
Right.
And, of course, the impact on independent toy stores is huge as well.
Right.
And now we're seeing them do it with groceries, and they're going to do it with consumer electronics. And that is theoretically illegal, but we don't really prosecute that anymore.
Why don't we?
It is a long history going back about 30 years of this shift in how we think about antitrust. I mean, some of it goes back to the Reagan administration and the fact that funding for antitrust enforcement was cut dramatically and was never reinstated in subsequent administrations.
Yeah.
But it also has to do with a sort of philosophical shift that has gone on in the courts and in the enforcement agencies, where they've kind of gotten very short-term in their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at something like that and they say, well, but Walmart's bringing the consumer a lower price in the short term, and that's all they're really focused on. The danger, of course, is that once Walmart gets the market share and puts those other businesses out, it then raises its price.
Exactly.
And that long-term thinking is no longer part of antitrust enforcement. And indeed, you know, there's a study I have in the book that I think is quite astounding from Nebraska that finds that Walmart does indeed charge more at some outlets than at others, and the higher prices are in places where there's no competition.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, amazingly, we're almost out of time, and there's so much more we really want to talk about. But let me ask you this question. If Americans prefer to shop this way, if they like enormous self-service stores with everything under one roof, you know, maybe those places really can do it more efficiently. What does it really matter to our country if they take over and everybody does all their shopping at those places? What do we lose if that happens?
We lose so much. I mean, we lose economically in significant ways. We lose higher quality jobs. We lose the independent businesses and what it means. I mean, small business is the backbone of America, and it has been for a long time. Mm. Our communities lose our environment. There's a big environmental price to be paid for this. And I think it also means that we lose as consumers. There is, you know, there's something that independent retailers bring. They bring a certain, they bring a degree of passion and expertise to what it is that they do that's often, you know, really outmatches what you get at the chains. The case I make in this book is that, one, that there's a big hidden cost for this, and that we really need to be looking at that in terms of our shopping decisions. But another part of what I argue in this book is that we didn't get to this point solely because of consumer choices.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, government policy has played a major role through subsidies, tax breaks, all these favors. I mean, it's really shocking and scandalous to read about that government has given to these big retailers and how they have systematically undermined the survival of independent businesses. So we need to change policy to make sure that there's at least a level playing field, as well as looking at the hidden cost of this. And I, you know, also just want to point out that this is a book that the whole second half of is devoted to what communities can and are doing across the country to reverse the trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're really out of time, but I have one last little question for you. What can one individual do who doesn't want the kind of future that we're talking about here? What can one single consumer do?
Well, look at how you can shift your spending, more of it to independent retailers. Look for those opportunities to spend more of your dollars locally. Talk to your local elected officials about what kind of land use policies and economic development policies you have in place. And then also talk to local retailers. One of the most important things that we're seeing out there is independent retailers, you know, banding together to get strength in numbers and to start talking about the importance of shopping locally owned.
And we're going to talk to one of those organizers in just a moment after this break. Stacy Mitchell, thank you so much for writing the book.
Yes.
And B, for being here with us today.
That was great.
Especially for writing the book. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Everyone loves a community cookbook, but it's not often that one comes along like Variations and Improvisations, produced by friends of KEDM Public Radio. This cookbook is gorgeous on the outside and delicious on the inside. You won't find many casseroles here, but you will find recipes for putting together fresh ingredients in new and tasty ways. The rich appetizer section includes tempting recipes for blue cheesecake with rosemary walnuts, caviar artichokes, goat balls, lemon rosemary wafers, and orange olives. Some of the outstanding pasta recipes include linguine salad with marinated tomatoes, pasta with bacon, fried pecans, and corn, pasta with garlic and hot peppers, and Thai peanut chicken and noodle salad. Most of the recipes can be prepared in less than half an hour, leaving you time to enjoy the music and wine recommendations in the book. Variations and Improvisations. It's the cookbook you'll turn to every day. Available at your local independent bookseller. Welcome back to the Book Report. We're going to be joined now by Mary Gay Shipley. She's the owner of That Bookstore in Blytheville. For 30 years, That Bookstore has been a center of books and reading in northeastern Arkansas. Writers of every stripe have signed books there, including John Grisham, Charles Frazier, Bobby Ann Mason, and many dozens and probably hundreds more. Mary Gay, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. We hope you're having a lively and exhausting holiday season at That Bookstore.
Oh, we're trying to do our best to just be worn out every day.
Oh, that's great. We've asked you to join us today, Mary Gay, because we know that you have been very active in your community, working with other merchants to try to keep your downtown alive. Talk to us about how all of this started and when, please.
Well, you know, Pat, we opened our store 30 years ago and moved downtown and thought, you know, it doesn't matter if you have the finest bookstore in America or all the world. If the rest of it all around you is falling down, it just really isn't going to work.
Right.
So we started very early on working on an application to become a Main Street town.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that. I would have to say over the 16 years we've been a Main Street town, we've done some wonderful things. It's just not all the things that we think we ought to have.
Mm-hmm.
But we are, I think, kind of at a crossroads right now. In the between that time, we've lost the Air Force Base, which was a fourth of our population.
Right.
After the NAFTA trade agreement, we lost a lot of small manufacturing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lost another whole group of our population. The town has shrunk, remarkably since then. However, we have had this underpinning of the steel industries.
Right.
And we have a huge component of the steel industries now. So that has helped us maintain the community.
That's great.
So that's been really, really good. We now have in place, which I think is crucial, I was trying to think of things that if people are listening to this and are,
mm-hmm.
You just really need to look at your leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We now have a mayor who understands the importance of Main Street.
Good.
We now have industry people who are saying out loud
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you have to have a viable downtown or nobody else is going to come here.
Yeah.
And the people that we try to interview and try to recruit to work in our industries do not want to come here unless you have a viable downtown.
Right, right. And you've got to have those partnerships in your
you
town.
You have to have those. And for the first time in my business life, people are actually saying those things out loud.
Good. That's great.
Good.
Which is really, really good. And we have also on board for the last couple of years a very dynamic Chamber of Commerce person who in fact does believe in downtowns and Main Street programs and things like that. So I think that is crucial because it's the first time in my experience with this downtown and this Main Street that we've ever had the serious attention of all those policy
right.
and decision makers.
Right. Now, Mary Gay, you've got less than 2 minutes. You've
Uh-oh.
Got a great project going on right now.
Yes, we have. Let me tell you about our Chamber gift certificates. They started
okay.
this year. It cost the Chamber $600 to do this. They look like checks. They work like checks. They're good at any Chamber membership. So this is an effort to get people to buy into a gift certificate that could be used in every Chamber member. So it supports the small businesses in our area. And it's really exciting. They've sold about 17,000 of them since they
wow.
started in October. And it's kind of a soft opening. There wasn't a whole lot of hoopla about it. I think
that's a ton, Mary Gay. That's a ton.
It is a ton. That's right. But we want to, you know me, we always want more.
And they can use these at some big stores as well.
You can use them at the big
stores. Any Chamber member.
You can use them at the grocery stores. You can use them at the gas station.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You can use them at anybody who is a Chamber member.
And do like companies buy these as Christmas gifts
yes,
for their...
Yes, they do.
Oh,
that's what we want to get into. And because we were kind of late getting them started, they, you know, it takes a trickle effect. You have to take one into your store before
right.
you and your staff really know how to handle them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
right.
in bigger places and in fast food places where the person taking the money may only be 16.
Oh, right. yeah. That's
so it's going to take a while for them to catch on, but it is really a no-brainer.
That's fantastic. I think we're going to talk to our chamber and our mayor and everyone else around here about that project. Mary Gay, thank you for being with us, and thank you for keeping the spirit alive in Blytheville.
You're welcome. It's nice to have a good Southport down there, keeping it going down in the south end.
All right, everybody go out and shop your local stores.
Shop
Thanks, Mary Gay.
Stores.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you all next week on The Book Report.
The Book Report has been brought to you by Windows A Bookshop, a community-centered independent bookstore in Monroe, Louisiana. The show was written and produced by co-hosts Pat Grant and Elizabeth Grant Gibson. The music was composed and performed by Charles Patton. To learn more about the books and writers mentioned in this show, visit thebookreport.net.